A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about conflict avoidance. That thing where someone does something that bothers you, and instead of saying anything, you just hold it in. Maybe communicate it through tone of voice or a pointed silence, but never actually address it. He's wondering how many people fall into this pattern, where it comes from, especially when it traces back to environments where speaking up got you punished, and what specific steps someone can take to build healthier communication habits.
That feeling, the tight chest, the swallowed words, isn't a character flaw. It's a learned neural pathway, and like any pathway, it can be mapped, understood, and rebuilt. Let's start with the map.
What exactly are we talking about here? Because I think a lot of people hear conflict avoidance and think, well, I'm just easygoing, I'm picking my battles. Where's the line?
That's the right question to start with. The behavior cluster we're looking at has three main components. First, conflict avoidance itself. The active suppression of disagreement or negative feedback even when a legitimate concern exists. Second, passive aggression. That's the sarcasm, the silent treatment, the backhanded compliment that lets you express frustration while maintaining what the brain perceives as plausible deniability. And third, emotional suppression, where you're not just choosing not to speak, you're actually preventing yourself from fully experiencing the emotion in the first place.
The plausible deniability piece is interesting. It's like the brain is running a covert operation against someone while maintaining diplomatic relations.
That's exactly what it is. And the distinction from healthy restraint is crucial. Choosing not to escalate because you've decided this isn't the right time, or this issue isn't worth the relational cost. That's discernment. That's wisdom, actually. The difference is whether you could express the concern if you wanted to. The avoidant person can't. The mechanism is involuntary.
It's not, I'm choosing not to engage. It's, I am physically incapable of opening my mouth right now, and I'm going to spend the next 3 hours mentally composing the conversation I should have had.
You're going to deliver that conversation to no one except the inside of your skull at 2 a.m. The prevalence data on this is striking. The American Psychological Association's Stress in America survey from 2023 found that 42% of adults report often avoiding difficult conversations. 42%. That's not a fringe behavior. That's approaching a majority experience. And 31% say they usually express anger indirectly rather than addressing it head on.
Nearly a third of adults are doing the passive-aggressive tango on a regular basis. That's a lot of silent treatments, and no, everything's fine when everything is very much not fine.
Here's what makes this worth taking seriously beyond just the relational friction. Chronic conflict suppression isn't just unpleasant, it's physiologically expensive. A 2021 study in psychoneuroendocrinology found that habitual emotional suppression elevates baseline cortisol by 18 to 22%. That's not a small bump. Cortisol is the body's primary stress hormone, and sustained elevation of that magnitude increases cardiovascular reactivity, impairs immune function over time, and has been linked to everything from hypertension to memory problems.
You're not just avoiding an awkward conversation. You're running your body at a higher baseline of stress, indefinitely, because you never discharge the pressure.
The body keeps the score, as the saying goes, and the brain is doing something very specific during these moments. So if 42% of us are doing this, the question isn't, why are we so broken? It's what taught our brains that silence is safer than speech. The answer starts in childhood, but it lives in your amygdala.
All right, walk me through what's happening in the brain during one of these moments. Someone says something at work that crosses a line. I feel the impulse to speak up. I don't. What just happened?
You've got two key players here. The amygdala is your threat detection system. It's fast, it's crude, and it doesn't distinguish well between physical danger and social danger. When someone does something that bothers you, and your brain has learned that expressing dissent is risky, the amygdala fires as if you're facing a physical threat. It triggers what's essentially a freeze response.
Not fight or flight.
Freeze is the third less discussed branch of the acute stress response. In social threat detection, the freeze response manifests as that moment where your throat tightens, your breathing goes shallow, and you literally cannot produce words. It's not that you're choosing silence. Your prefrontal cortex, which handles rational decision-making and impulse control, is getting overridden by the amygdala's threat signal.
My higher brain is losing a wrestling match to my lizard brain in real time.
The lizard brain is faster. The amygdala processes threats in about 50 milliseconds. The prefrontal cortex takes significantly longer to engage in reasoned analysis. By the time you've consciously thought, "I should say something," the amygdala has already hijacked the decision and locked down your vocal cords. The anterior cingulate cortex is also involved. It detects the mismatch between what you're feeling and what you're expressing. That mismatch creates cognitive dissonance, which is part of why these moments feel so viscerally uncomfortable.
The brain is simultaneously screaming danger, and you're being inauthentic. That's a recipe for internal chaos.
The pattern gets reinforced every time. Each time you suppress, the neural pathway gets a little stronger. Your brain learns that silence prevented the anticipated negative outcome, even though you can't actually know what would have happened if you'd spoken up. It's operant conditioning. The behavior is negatively reinforced by the removal of the anticipated threat.
Which brings us to where this conditioning usually starts.
A 2020 meta-analysis in the journal Attachment and Human Development estimated that about 25% of the population has an avoidant attachment style. These are people who learned early in life that expressing needs or distress didn't reliably produce comfort. It might have produced withdrawal, punishment, or indifference. So the adaptive strategy becomes, don't express needs. Maintain emotional distance as a protective mechanism.
That's not a personality quirk. That's a survival adaptation.
It's a brilliant adaptation to a specific environment. The problem is when the environment changes, but the adaptation doesn't. There's a 2018 longitudinal study from the University of Rochester that tracked children from early childhood through age 25. The finding was striking. Children raised in authoritarian households, where expressing disagreement led to yelling, withdrawal of affection, or physical discipline, showed 2.3 times higher rates of conflict, avoidance at age 25 compared to peers from households where dissent was handled more constructively.
2.3 times? So this isn't subtle. The childhood environment is directly predictive of adult communication patterns a quarter century later.
It makes intuitive sense. If every time you spoke up as a kid, the response was punitive, someone yelled at you, someone withdrew love, someone made you feel unsafe, your brain learned a very clear lesson. Silence equals safety. Expression equals danger. That's not a lesson that unlearns itself just because you're now an adult in a different context.
The brain doesn't automatically update its threat database when you move out of your parents' house.
It does not. And here's where passive aggression enters the picture. The brain still needs to discharge the frustration somehow. You can't just feel nothing. So it develops a workaround. Express the frustration in ways that maintain plausible deniability. The sarcastic comment. The forgotten commitment. The tone of voice that communicates contempt while the words themselves are neutral. The brain gets to vent the pressure without triggering the threat response associated with direct confrontation.
It's the emotional equivalent of keying someone's car instead of telling them you're angry.
About as effective at actually resolving anything. There's a phenomenon researchers call the door slam. Years of suppressed resentment building up until one day, the person simply terminates the relationship, often to the complete shock of the other party. The other person had no idea anything was wrong because nothing was ever communicated. It's the boiling frog mechanism applied to relationships.
Let me give you a concrete example, because I think this helps ground it. Imagine Sarah, 34 years old, project manager. She never pushes back on unrealistic deadlines. Her boss says we need this by Friday, and Sarah knows it's a two-week project. But she says okay. Then at 10 p.m. on Thursday night, she sends an email with subject line per my previous email, and a tone that could curdle milk.
fMRI studies of people in Sarah's position show amygdala activation roughly 40% higher during conflict scenarios than peers who have learned to speak up directly. Her brain is lighting up like she's facing a physical threat. The deadline conversation isn't just uncomfortable, her nervous system is treating it as dangerous.
Knowing why your brain does this is useful, but it doesn't change the behavior by itself. You need a toolkit, And the good news is, there are specific, evidence-based techniques that work. Let's build that toolkit.
I want to start with a framework from dialectical behavior therapy, DBT. It's called Dear Man, and it's one of the most well-validated interpersonal effectiveness tools in clinical psychology. Each letter is a step. D is describe. State the facts of the situation without judgment or interpretation. E is express. Use I feel statements to communicate your emotional response. A is assert. Ask directly for what you need. R is reinforce. Explain the positive outcome if your request is honored.
Then man is about the how. Mindful. Appear confident. Negotiate.
Let me walk through a full script for a common scenario. A coworker who interrupts you in meetings. Describe. In the last three team meetings, you've spoken over me while I was making a point. That's just facts, no accusation. Express. I feel frustrated and disrespected when that happens. Assert. I need you to let me finish my thoughts before responding. Reinforce. If we can do that, I think our meetings will be more productive and I'll feel more comfortable contributing.
What I notice about that script is that it never attacks the person's character. It's not you're rude or you're a bad colleague. It's specific behaviors and specific impacts.
That's the core insight behind the CBT assertiveness script. When you do X, I feel Y because Z. I need W. The structure works because it separates behavior from identity. When you say you're rude, the other person's defenses go up immediately. Now it's about who they are as a person. When you say, when you interrupt me, I feel frustrated, you're describing an action and its effect. Far harder to argue with.
The I need part is crucial. You're not just complaining. You're providing a path forward.
A 2024 study in the Journal of Social Psychology found something remarkable about phrasing. Starting with, I'd prefer if, instead of you need to, reduce defensive responses by 80%. The difference between a demand and a preference expression is enormous in how the other person's nervous system receives it.
That's the minimum viable assertiveness concept. You're not making a demand, you're expressing a preference. I'd prefer if we could start the meeting at 10 instead of 9. Versus, you need to stop scheduling meetings so early. Same core message, completely different reception.
For someone who's never been assertive, starting with I'd prefer is far more accessible than starting with I need you to. It lowers the activation energy. You're not jumping into full confrontation mode, you're just stating a preference. That's something the amygdala can handle.
Let's talk about exposure therapy for conflict. Because this is where the rewiring actually happens. You can't think your way out of an amygdala response. You have to practice your way out.
This is the graded exposure hierarchy approach, and it's backed by solid evidence. A 2022 randomized controlled trial from Stanford found that 8 weeks of structured assertiveness training reduced avoidance behavior by 63%. 63%! That's not incremental improvement. That's transformation.
The graded part matters. You don't start by confronting your boss about a decade of mistreatment. You start with something that barely registers as conflict.
Week one might be disagreeing on a movie choice with a friend. I'd prefer not to watch another Marvel movie tonight. How about something else? Week two, ask for a different table at a restaurant. Week three, push back on a minor deadline at work. Week four, address a recurring behavioral issue with a partner. Each step builds evidence for your brain that expression doesn't lead to catastrophe.
The brain is gathering counter-evidence to the childhood lesson. Every time you speak up and the world doesn't end, the amygdala's threat association weakens a little.
That's exactly the mechanism. It's the same principle as treating a phobia. You don't cure a fear of spiders by reading about spiders. You gradually expose yourself to spiders in controlled conditions until the fear response extinguishes.
There's also the 5-second rule, adapted for conflict. Mel Robbins' technique. If you feel the urge to speak within 5 seconds of a triggering event, say it before your amygdala hijacks the decision. The window is small.
Because after 5 seconds, the prefrontal cortex has had time to generate all the reasons not to speak. Maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe they didn't mean it. Maybe this isn't the right time. Maybe I should just let it go. The rationalization engine kicks in and you've lost the moment.
Then you're back to composing the conversation in your head at 2 a.m.
The body language component is also worth addressing, because it's something you can control even when you're anxious. Research from Harvard Business School in 2023 found that nonverbal cues, open posture, steady eye contact at about 60-70% of the time, not staring, and a slightly lower vocal pitch, increase perceived assertiveness by 34% regardless of what words you're actually saying.
You can fake it until your brain catches up.
The fascinating thing is that adopting confident body language doesn't just change how others perceive you, it changes how you perceive yourself. There's a bidirectional feedback loop between posture and emotional state. Standing or sitting with an open posture actually reduces cortisol and increases testosterone, which is associated with confidence and willingness to take social risks.
It's the power pose idea, though the original research on that was somewhat overhyped. The core mechanism is real, even if the effect size is smaller than initially claimed.
The effect is modest but measurable. More importantly, it gives you something concrete to focus on in the moment. When you're feeling the freeze response, tight throat, shallow breath, you can consciously adjust your posture, take a breath, make eye contact. Those are actions you can take even when you can't yet find the words.
Let's talk about what happens after you fail, because anyone trying to change this pattern is going to have moments where they default back to avoidance, and then the shame spiral kicks in.
This is where the Gottman Institute's work on repair attempts is invaluable. They have a protocol called the aftermath of a fight, but it applies equally to conflict-avoidant episodes. The key is circling back after the moment has passed and re-engaging constructively. You say something like, "Hey, earlier when you said that thing about the project timeline, I didn't say anything in the moment, but I realized afterward that it bothered me. Can we talk about it?"
That's huge, because the avoidant person's instinct after a failed attempt is to think, "Well, I blew it. The moment's gone. Nothing I can do now." And that's just the avoidance pattern reasserting itself in a new costume.
The repair attempt breaks that loop. It also teaches your brain that missing the 5-second window isn't catastrophic. You can still address the issue later. That reduces the pressure to be perfect, which paradoxically makes it easier to speak up in the moment.
It's the difference between, "I must speak up immediately or forever hold my peace, and I'd prefer to address this now, but I can always circle back."
For someone with an avoidant history, that permission to be imperfect is essential. The all-or-nothing thinking, "If I can't be perfectly assertive, I won't try at all," is part of what maintains the pattern.
Let me pull together a concrete graded exposure hierarchy so listeners have something to work with. Week 1. Disagree on a low-stakes preference with a friend. Restaurant choice, movie selection, where to walk. Week 2. Make a small request in a service context. Ask for a different table. Request a substitution on a menu item. Week 3. Push back on a minor work issue. A deadline that's slightly unreasonable. A meeting time that doesn't work. Week 4. Address a recurring pattern with someone close to you. When you do X, I feel Y.
The key is that each week builds on the last. By the time you get to week 4, you've accumulated multiple data points that expression doesn't lead to disaster. Your amygdala has new evidence to work with.
There's another technique I want to flag, and it's deceptively simple. Just track your avoidance for 2 weeks. Every time a conflict opportunity arises, rate on a scale of 1 to 10 how much you avoided it. 1 is, "I said exactly what I needed to say." 10 is, "I pretended everything was fine and then complained to my spouse about it for 45 minutes.
The self-monitoring effect, also known as the Hawthorne effect in research contexts, is well documented. The mere act of tracking a behavior reduces its frequency by roughly 15 to 20%. You become more aware of the pattern in real time, and that awareness creates a pause between the impulse to suppress and the act of suppression.
The pause is everything. That's the space where choice lives.
I'd add the accountability partner concept. Find one person, a friend, a partner, a colleague you trust, and check in with them weekly about one conversation you had that you would have previously avoided. The social accountability adds motivation, and the debrief helps you process what worked and what didn't.
We've covered the neuroscience and the techniques, but knowing and doing are different things. Here are 3 concrete actions you can take starting today.
First, the 3-step micro practice. Step 1. Notice the physical sensation of avoidance when it happens. That tightness in your throat, the shallow breathing, the tension in your shoulders. Just notice it. Step 2. Take a 3-second grounding breath. Inhale for 4 counts, hold for 4, exhale for 6. This activates the parasympathetic nervous system and dampens the amygdala's threat response. Step 3, say one sentence using the when you, even if it's just, when you said that, I felt a bit uncomfortable.
The breathing step is not optional. You cannot talk your way out of an amygdala hijack. You have to calm the nervous system first. The breath is the fastest lever you have.
Second action, adopt the minimum viable assertiveness concept. Start with expressing a preference, not a demand. I'd prefer if, instead of you need to, as that Journal of Social Psychology study showed, the single phrasing shift reduces defensive responses by 80%. It's also much easier for you to say.
Third action. Track your avoidance score for 2 weeks. Every evening, think back over the day and rate each conflict opportunity from 1 to 10 on how much you avoided it. Don't judge yourself for the scores. Just record them. The awareness alone will start shifting the pattern.
If you want to go further, add the accountability partner and start working through a graded exposure hierarchy. These aren't theoretical exercises. They're skills you build the way you'd build any other skill, through repeated practice with increasing difficulty.
You've got the tools, but there's one question that keeps coming up, and it's worth sitting with. Is there a point where assertiveness becomes aggression? How do you calibrate the right level of directness for different relationships and different cultural contexts?
That's the frontier question, and it doesn't have a simple answer. Assertiveness is about clarity and respect for both parties' needs. Aggression violates the other person's boundaries. But in practice, the line can be fuzzy, and it varies across cultures. What counts as appropriately direct in a New York boardroom might read as aggressive in a context where indirect communication is the norm.
There's a gender dimension here, too. The same directness that's perceived as assertive in a man is often perceived as aggressive or difficult in a woman. So, the calibration isn't just about individual psychology. It's about navigating social expectations that aren't evenly distributed.
This is where the appear confident piece of Dear Man gets complicated. The Harvard research on nonverbal cues is useful, but it's operating within existing social frameworks that aren't always fair. I think the practical guidance is, calibrate to the relationship and the context, but don't let the fear of being perceived as aggressive keep you from being direct. The cost of chronic suppression is too high.
There's also emerging research on AI-assisted communication coaching that's worth watching. Apps that analyze your text messages and suggest more assertive phrasing in real time. The first peer-reviewed trial from the MIT Media Lab is expected later this year.
That's fascinating. The idea of having a real-time communication coach in your pocket, something that can flag a passive-aggressive phrasing before you hit send and suggest a more direct alternative. It's like training wheels for assertiveness.
Potentially a bridge for people who can't access therapy or coaching. The scalability of an app-based intervention versus one-on-one clinical work is orders of magnitude different.
Though I'd want to see the data on whether the skills transfer to in-person communication. It's one thing to revise a text message with AI assistance, another thing entirely to speak up in a meeting when your amygdala is firing.
That's the million-dollar question. Does the app train the underlying neural pathway, or does it just produce better texts?
We'll know more when that MIT trial lands. But even if it only helps with written communication, that's still a significant piece of the puzzle. A huge amount of modern conflict happens over text and email.
All right, let me pull this together. The core insight here is that conflict avoidance isn't a personality flaw. It's a learned neural pathway, usually installed in childhood environments where speaking up was punished. Roughly 42% of adults report often avoiding difficult conversations. The amygdala treats social confrontation as a physical threat, triggering a freeze response that overrides the prefrontal cortex. Chronic suppression raises cortisol by 18 to 22%. Passive aggression is the brain's workaround for discharging frustration while maintaining plausible deniability.
The path forward is specific and evidence-based. The Dear Man framework from DBT. The When You script from CBT. Graded exposure hierarchies, starting with low-stakes disagreements and working up. An 8-week structured program can reduce avoidance behavior by 63%. The minimum viable assertiveness concept, start with I prefer rather than you need to. Track your avoidance. Find an accountability partner. Learn to circle back with repair attempts when you miss the moment.
The goal isn't to never feel the urge to avoid conflict. That urge is wired in. The goal is to have the choice. Every time you speak up, you're not just resolving an issue. You're rewiring a circuit. You're teaching your amygdala, one conversation at a time. That expression is safe.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, Soviet botanists studying epiphytic bromeliads in Patagonia discovered a single tillandsia specimen that had been growing on the same telegraph wire for at least 47 years, surviving exclusively on airborne moisture and dust, its root system long since vestigial, a complete ecosystem sustained by nothing but fog and patience.
Right. This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps other people find the show. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.